What does it mean to bring our whole selves into the world? To give ourselves the gift of unconditional acceptance? Join me as we learn together. I'm Jorgen Salvis, and this is Unshaming. So this month we are talking all about body image. Last week we talked about dieting. We talked about restricting, monitoring, obsessing about every little thing that goes inside our body. And the reason I wanted to do a series on body image was because I think that all of us, every single one of us, can spend at least 10, 15, sometimes even 20 minutes in front of the mirror picking apart all the little things about our bodies that we hate. And so I thought it was so important to kind of explore that and do a deep dive into it. So this week we are expanding on that conversation about body image, but sort of going in a different direction. We're talking about male body image and sort of like clockwork. Whenever I tell people that I'm the host of Unshaming, a host of a show called Unshaming and what it's about, they will always respond to me telling me what they're unshaming or what they have unshamed or what they've been through. And the number one response I always get from men is the shame of body image. And when I actually did some research on this, I found that according to the National Institute of Mental Health, men make up about 20% of those who confront an eating disorder. And those are just the men who report that they have these conditions. Thousands of men go without telling anyone about their difficulties with body image because of the stigma attached to it, that stigma of weakness. Men are not supposed to think about mental health. Men aren't supposed to have eating disorders. And men are not supposed to ask for help. I usually interview authors or activists or experts on the show, but a couple of weeks ago, I actually got a letter from an unshaming listener, who bared his soul. He wrote to me about his 20-year struggle with body dysmorphia, with restrictive dieting, with excessive exercise, anorexia, and bulimia. And despite everything that he had been through, he finished this letter saying, "I refuse to be defined or confined by shame." And I thought to myself, how unshaming is that? I have to have him on. And unshaming is really about telling the stories of silenced communities, silenced voices. And I thought to myself, how many men do I know who actually speak up about their issues with body image? I don't really know that many. So I thought this was just so perfect and so fitting. And I was just so inspired by his story. And I really think you will be too. Before we get into Antonio's story, I just want to remark that this episode contains frank discussion about eating disorders, purging, and suicidal thoughts. If you or someone you know would like to receive help or information on disordered eating, you can click the resources in the show notes. This is the shame of male body image. Why don't we start off by you telling us what your shame story is all about?
Yeah, my shame story revolves mainly around, you know, the norms and narratives and stigma of masculinity and what it really means to be a man, and how those guidelines for me turned into sort of a distorted body image, body dysmorphia, a continuing worsening eating disorder, and then really an utter and complete hatred and self-loathing about, you know, my body and what the ideal male physique was supposed to be.
So Antonio, I wonder if you can tell us, when did this really start for you?
Yeah, for me, it started pretty young. I was about 8 or 9 years old, I think. You know, I started getting really bullied heavily at school, kind of tortured, you know, by the other kids in my class. mainly because I was a little bit overweight as a kid, but also because even though I was a boy, I had breasts, actually pretty big, sort of prominent breasts, you know, and the reason was because I had something called gynecomastia, which is really just, you know, overdeveloped male breast tissue. So, you know, it resulted in a chest that was very different than most of the other boys in my class. You know, I didn't have pecs, right? Like they did. I had breasts, and mine was a pretty severe case. So, you know, I developed breasts quicker than most of the girls in my class. And I had bigger breasts than many of them for the majority of my elementary and middle school years. You know, the kids in my schoolyard would hold their t-shirts out in 2 points around the nipple area and kind of walk around effeminately mocking me. And it was a pretty regular occurrence at pretty much every recess. And, you know, I just was so embarrassed. I just wanted to disappear, right? I wanted to run away. You know, I prayed every night before going to sleep, you know, that in the morning I'd wake up just in a different body and be somewhat normal.
And how was that making you feel at the time?
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty crushing and pretty lonesome. And I remember one day in the schoolyard, this probably paints the perfect picture. I remember it like it was yesterday. You know, I was standing around with a few of the boys from my class and a few of the girls just before going away from summer vacation. One of the girls started talking about her crushes, right? And how at one point throughout the school year, she had pretty much had a crush on like every boy in the class. But just as she finished admitting this to all of us, she quickly turned to me and sort of looked me right in the face and said, "Well, of course, except for you, Antonio, I never had a crush on you." And honestly, Jor, I'll never be able to quantify or explain the amount of rejection and hurt I felt in that moment. And
humiliation.
Like my heart felt like it had been ripped out and stepped on like a million times.
And you had attributed all of this to your condition.
Yeah. I mean, I felt like I was the outlier, right? I felt like I was this, you know, sort of disgusting, you know, anomaly that, that nobody, you know, could ever like or deem attractive. And I thought mainly it was because of, you know, being overweight and also because I had these breasts that no other boy, you know, that I had seen, in my life to that point had ever had.
And so during our conversations, you had mentioned that you at this age were thinking about getting surgery to remove the breast tissue. How old were you?
Yeah, I was around 12 years old at that point.
You were 12?
Yeah.
Wow, you were 12 and wanting to get surgery to modify your body. So walk us through what that moment was like when you decided to get it, kind of leading up to it. Because I imagine it had to have been really intense, the bullying, for you to come to that decision.
You know, around 9 or 10 actually is when I really started to, you know, develop a really acute awareness about my body, you know, as the bullying sort of continued and progressed. And I started to form, you know, a really sort of foundational feeling or thinking that I was just this error, you know, this kind of repulsive biological mistake. And so for about 3 years, from the time I was 9 to about 12 years old, I would, you know, just spend hours in the bathroom, locked in the bathroom, sort of staring in the mirror, crying uncontrollably, you know, and just really like shouting at my reflection, like how disgusting, you know, I felt I was, and, you know, that nobody liked me and that nobody was ever going to like me. And it would go on again for hours and hours and hours, basically, you know, every single night. You know, that ultimately, you know, led me, you know, around the preteen sort of puberty years to really start to question how I could fix this thing that I felt was wrong with me. And that's where surgery came about through some conversations with my doctors.
So what was that moment like? You decide to get the surgery. Are your parents on board? Are you nervous about this? How does the surgery go?
Yeah. So my parents were hopeful that, you know, this would, you know, sort of correct itself over time. But I was so miserable as a kid, right? And I begged them so much to kind of bring me to the doctor and sort of try to get me help. And, you know, ultimately I got referred to a plastic surgeon, you know, with my parents at around 12 or 13 years old. I had to make this really massive decision, right? To get this really intensive, intrusive, invasive surgery. But it didn't really feel like a choice, to be honest, right? It felt like I had to get the surgery. I needed it to correct the mistakes, right? To correct the biological error, you know, that, and the surgery seemed like the only way, you know, I was ever going to be sort of freed from that embarrassment and that shame and that humiliation. The sort of beliefs I'd created, you know, in my head about myself, you know, I thought that this surgery was just going to kind of, you know, not only fix the physical, but fix the mental at the same time, right? I just, you know, the same way that the sort of breast tissue was going to get, you know, lifted out and removed, you know, I thought maybe all this emotional pain that I'd connected with it would also get removed, you know, all in one sort of, you know, surgery. And again, you know, as a kid, I didn't really understand what the surgery entailed, what the recovery entailed. I was so hell bent to get this done and just move forward and try to leave this part of my life that I hated so much in the past, that I just decided to go for it. Right. And so, yeah, I mean, I got this operation and for weeks afterwards, you know, I had tubes running from my chest, draining excess fluid buildup. You know, I was so bruised. You know, it looked like I was hit by a truck. You'd think that something terrible had happened to me. And then, you know, once the tubes and the bandages got removed, about a month afterward, I had to wear this compression vest, right? And it was this like sort of full torso corset type thing to keep everything tight and sort of cinched up. And I was only supposed to wear it for a couple of months, but I ended up sort of wearing it for over a year. It became this security blanket for me almost, right? I mean, I had to go back to school, you know, after this surgery. I did it during the summer break. And so I had to go back to school and I was still wearing this vest underneath my clothes. When I went back, I mean, literally, Jor, everything changed suddenly, immediately. You know, I wasn't getting bullied anymore. The other kids in the class wanted to be friends. Girls started to show some interest in me. And this whole new world that I didn't even imagine could have existed started, you know, opening up to me. And I became addicted to it, you know, to that sort of external validation.
The attention.
And absolutely. And I ended up sort of connecting my physical appearance to that feeling, right? And to that level of interest and attention that I was now receiving. It just sort of created or reconfirmed that core belief that in order to have friends, in order to, you know, get a girlfriend, I had to look a certain way, right?
Well, Antonio, you know, in all the interviews that I have done on this show, that child inside of us does not really become healed until we heal them. So, you know, the boy that was crying in front of the mirror every night, was he still the boy inside of you, even though you had a new body? Were you still feeling as though you were inferior internally?
It's an interesting question because I think I wasn't probably fully aware of it, but I think, you know, I think a part of me stayed 12 years old, you know, and always, you know, had stayed 12 years old until I sort of opened the box 18 years later and sort of really tried to confront all of those demons and all of those issues. I think I was a little bit blind or drunk with attention and with, you know, this new life that I was living, that I was able to kind of bury and push down those issues. But I think that crying child, you know, that child who believed that he was nothing, you know, not worth anything, never, he would never be liked really for who he was actually. I think that child was always in there. And so as I aged and as I matured, this 12-year-old would kind of be knocking at the door when things got stressful. And when I wanted to, you know, have relationships or whatnot, this sort of sense of just shame and inferiority and sort of, you know, emasculation that was living beneath the surface kind of would rear its ugly head and kind of, you know, cause me to question myself and withdraw. And so, yeah, I think I never really sort of dealt with it, you know, until about 18 years later.
How was this manifesting for you?
You know, my entire life became about doing everything to hang on to that new lifestyle, right? I started, you know, working out with weights, excessively exercising. You know, I had put, again, all of my self-worth and self-value into my appearance. And you know, at the end of it, I started to develop, you know, a pretty severe eating disorder that progressed throughout my teens and my adult years. And it began around, you know, 13 or 14 years old. You know, coming from a traditional Italian household, my mother, who I love dearly, would pack me a nice full lunch for school every day, you know, a big sandwich and snacks. And, you know, every single day without missing one, the first thing I did in the morning when I got to school was throw that entire lunch straight in the garbage can, right? Straight in the trash. This lunch that was made with love and care and affection, I looked at it as poison almost. I looked at it as something I wasn't allowed, I couldn't allow myself to enjoy. And so I didn't give myself an option, right? I didn't feel I deserved it. I didn't want it. And so I just would throw it out right when I got to school first thing in the morning.
We'll be right back.
Hey, I'm Ronald and I'm a producer for Unshaming. I grew up low income, but rarely ever saw stories like mine authentically portrayed in media. That's why I loved our episode on growing up low income. I heard myself and my experiences in that story. That's the kind of work we're doing at Unshaming. We're creating a platform for all of the silenced and stigmatized voices of society. If you support this kind of work, you can support Unshaming by donating to our Patreon at patreon.com/unshaming. Your contributions help us to bring these inspiring stories to even more people. Once again, that's patreon.com/unshaming. And keep on unshaming.
This is so interesting for me to hear, because I think in all of the folks that I've interviewed who have had experiences with disordered eating, it stems from control. And so when you say that the eating disorder began to spiral, life began to change, stress began to skyrocket, and this was your way of controlling your life, or feeling as though you could stay in control.
Yeah, I mean, I think at first it really started, yeah, to take control over my situation as a teenager, trying to be attractive to girls, trying to make friends, trying to never have to look at myself in the mirror crying, you know, telling myself that I'm disgusting. So yeah, I mean, I think for sure, you know, that piece of trying to take control over my life and change my surroundings, I think was how it started. And then, and yeah, that thread continued, you know, throughout the rest of my life. I think I always sort of fell back into the more severe disordered eating when, you know, I was really stressed out, when exams were around, when I was trying to juggle work and school, or, you know, trying to have some fun and still keep my grades up. And then, you know, ultimately when I graduated and started, you know, a full-time job, you know, you're sitting at a desk 9 to 5 every day. You're not working out, you know, you're not exercising as much as you'd like. And you start to worry, right? You start to worry about putting on weight. You start to worry about returning to that 12-year-old kid, right? That overweight kid who nobody liked. And so the way that you can sort of control that or avoid that is to control your food intake. Or, you know, for me, it got to the point where not only was, you know, I dealing with restrictive eating and, you know, anorexia, it really turned into full on sort of, you know, binge eating and bulimia as well.
From my perspective, Antonio, you are part of this big Italian family. You are working a job that's 9 to 5. How were you able to, I guess, for lack of better terms, get away with the bulimia and with the binging without people noticing?
Yeah, you know, it's a really good question, but I think you eat certain things, you toss things into a napkin, you know, you throw them out when nobody's looking. You know, I was also very talkative and very sort of life of the party. And when you're sort of deflecting that attention onto other, you know, parts of your personality, you know, it's easier to kind of to get away with, you know, some of these, you know, some of these disordered eating habits. When you are sort of an individual and an independent person, you know, who's very sort of irritable and very sort of obsessive about these things, people around you who love you don't want to push you away as much as they might want to confront you or call you on some of the things that they're seeing. You know, it's really difficult. You know, for me, Jor, it got to the point where, you know, had my family, you know, had intervened and really sort of, you know, pushed me to get help before I was ready, you know, I would have ran. I don't know. I can't say for sure that I wouldn't have just, you know, literally packed my bags and ran away to a different city or just completely cut off communication. That's how bad it got.
So what was the peak of this? How did this begin to culminate? And what was that moment where you said to yourself, I need to get help?
Yeah, I mean, it was probably about 2 years ago. It had gotten so bad, honestly, you know, I could have dropped dead at any moment. You know, I was about
dropped dead of what? Of the weight loss?
Yeah, I mean, just malnourishment, excessive exercise. You know, I was lifting weights for 2.5 hours and completely in a calorie deficit every single day. You know, I could have went to bed at any point and, you know, my heart could have stopped. I'm 5'10", 120 pounds, right? You know, frail. I'm purging, you know, 15 times a day sometimes, right? And, you know, I was basically living,
wow.
Yeah, I was basically living in a world where anything I put in my body, I was trying to get it out. And when you're doing that, right, your electrolyte balance is completely out of whack. My white blood cell count had plummeted. I went to the doctor and, you know, I had blood work done and they basically said, like, you know, you can walk out of here and literally drop dead at any point. Like, your heart can stop because your potassium levels are so high. And, you know, it was just really, really at a point where I couldn't hide it and I couldn't deny it anymore. You know, I wasn't ready to face it totally. But I knew that I didn't have a choice.
So this was something that you had originally started to control your life and you were now out of control.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. My life had really started to spiral in a number of different ways, right? I had no relationships with friends or, you know, females for a long time, you know, years. I didn't want to be in any sort of social situation. I had no joy in anything. You know, my work performance was declining, you know, because I couldn't concentrate on anything. you know, my mind was so obsessed with food and eating. And also, you know, it was so fuzzy, you know, I was so malnourished that normal sort of simple cognitive function was, you know, a difficult thing for me. And so, yeah, I mean, it got to the point where I just sort of looked around and said, my entire life is in this downward spiral, you know, towards rock bottom. And it's all because of food and my body image and, you know, not being able to accept myself for who I was, and also not confronting that 12-year-old that was still living inside of me, you know?
Wow. I'm just going to let that sort of land for a moment. You have this revelation. You walk out of the doctor's office with this information. Mm-hmm. What happens next?
So my doctors and I, you know, refer me to, you know, I get the referral to an adult eating disorder program, a rehabilitation program. It was a, you know, a 12-week program for the eating disorder and sort of my depression at the time. And, you know, really it was to teach myself how to eat normally again and sort of change these distortions, you know, that I had built up about food and, you know, my body dysmorphia. And I don't think I was fully ready for it, but I knew I had no choice. And so I decided to enter this program. Honestly, it saved my life. You know, I'm not trying to be dramatic, but it literally brought me back from the edge of doing something, you know, that I'd regret for, you know, for the rest of my life, if my life was anything. And
what do you mean?
Yeah, I mean, I was borderline suicidal. You know, I mean, I don't know that I ever could have taken my own life, but many days, you know, I would go to bed and think, if I don't wake up tomorrow morning, I don't care. It's not the worst thing in the world. Like, it'll be relief at least, right? Like, it'll be relief from the pain and the burden that I'm putting on everyone else. And it would just be better. It would just be easier if I don't wake up tomorrow morning. That was every night for, you know, probably a year and a half. And, you know, I don't know, Jorah, where that would have went if I didn't get help.
So what happens once you're in the treatment facility? What is life like there?
Well, I mean, listen, let me first say I owe absolutely everything, right, to the doctors and the administrators of and the other group members, right, in that program that I was in. I don't know if I'd be here talking to you. I don't think I'd have the courage probably to speak, you know, as openly about it. But yeah, it was pretty much 3 days a week, you know, in this group program where, you know, you're eating in front of people, right? They're sort of, you know, watching you, you're on a meal plan, you're doing cognitive behavioral therapy, and they're teaching you, you know, what sort of breaking down your cognitive distortions and reteaching you what normal sort of people know about food and nutrition. You know, I got to be honest. I mean, that whole process was really tough for me because that program, you know, and really most eating disorder programs are geared toward females, right? Mainly towards females. I mean, most of the content and the stats and the examples, you know, provided are based on women because that's what the numbers say, right? The majority of people who suffer from eating disorders are females. You know, every doctor, every administrator in the program was female. Every group member was female. All of the content was female based. And, you know, I was literally the only male anywhere in the program in any capacity throughout the entire sort of process. And I couldn't help but feel sort of, you know, this constant subconscious reminder that once again, you know, I was the anomaly, you know, I was this outsider, this outlier, you know, I wasn't supposed to be there. This is not something I'm supposed to be dealing with. Men are not supposed to have these issues. It's no fault of anyone's, and I don't believe that that's true, but I was sort of, you know, being reminded of it sort of every single day I had to attend this program, and it was tough, you know. It was tough to get past that, but you know, once I did, and once I was able to commit and sort of lean fully into the program, I mean, the progress I made was pretty aggressive and pretty amazing.
When I think about society and the way that it works, we regard external accomplishments with so much value. We love when people tell us that they have gotten a new job, that they have lost weight, or that they have had this big achievement. But very, very rarely do we take moments to appreciate the internal accomplishments. I have gained more self-confidence. I feel more secure in myself. Mm-hmm. I have overcome this disorder that once controlled my life. Do you feel proud of yourself, Antonio?
You know, I will say you're right. I mean, we live in a society that tends to value those things that you mentioned because they're quantifiable, right? They're tangible. I can tell you how much money I make. I can show you the vehicle that I drive. I can invite you over to the house that I've bought, right? But I can't make you understand the progress I've made from an internal perspective, right? I can't show you my growth mentally or emotionally. And so I think that's why we sort of default into valuing, you know, those things that are easily, you know, quantifiable and easily sort of, they're easy to put a value on. But yeah, I mean, feeling proud is pretty foreign to me. You know, it's pretty uncomfortable, if I'm being honest. My upbringing, you know, it stressed modesty and humility. We, you know, didn't really ever celebrate accomplishments. We didn't want to seem, you know, showy or condescending to other people. So it just wasn't anything that I really ever grew up being comfortable with or really knowing and feeling like it was acceptable for me to feel that way. But if you were to really push me now, I'd say that I do feel proud, maybe for the first time ever in my life. Deep down, I do know that I did something extremely difficult. You know, I know that I hit my absolute rock bottom. I stared everything in the face, you know, all of my suicidal type of thoughts or thoughts about death. And I climbed my way out of that pit. I dug myself in, but I was able to climb back out. And I do think that that's something to feel a sense of accomplishment about.
Well, Antonio, if it means anything at all, I am so proud of you. And I think a lot of the people who are going to be listening to this show are going to be so proud of you. Not only for how far you've come, but just the rawness in which you talk about who you are and where you come from, the fearlessness and sharing your story and wanting others to know about this and wanting others who are perhaps going through something similar to not feel alone. I'm really proud of you and I'm so happy for you. So my next question for you, Antonio, I wonder, how is dating going? And I ask that because you seem to be on your self-enlightenment journey. Mm. It is hard to bring someone into that. It is really difficult to integrate someone into that. And so I'm wondering, how is that going for you right now?
You know, trying to sort of live a recovered life now. When's the right time to really open up and let somebody in and sort of let them judge whether they're able to handle what I've been through and sort of what the next little while together is going to look like? You know, obviously there's a very real fear of rejection that you might scare somebody off, you know, too early, or scare somebody off if you open up too early. I'm at a point where I just want to put all my cards on the table and fully dive in and be totally honest.
This is me.
And transparent. Yeah. I mean, listen, if that person can't deal with what you're telling them and what you've been through, they're not in it totally, right? They're not the right one for you. It wasn't going to work out anyway. It doesn't matter if you told them a month from now, a year from now, if they're not able to handle it now, they're probably never going to be able to handle it. And so I lived too much of my life in hiding, in sort of embarrassment and in shame. And I just don't want to do that anymore. I refuse to do that. I'm at a point in my life where this is me, take it or leave it. You know, eventually I think when you find the person who is able to handle it, it's going to be that much better and that much stronger.
I love that. So Antonio, what does unshaming for you, for Antonio, what does that look like today, after a large portion of your life spent in shame? Mm-hmm. Now you are in a new chapter of your life, in an unshaming chapter. What does that look like for you?
You know, externally, I made a conscious decision, like I said, to kind of, you know, live my life in full, open, honest, you know, transparency. And I decided to share my full story on, you know, my social media channels. And you know, I thought it was important to kind of hold myself accountable, you know, to the promise that I had made to myself to no longer hide and no longer be ashamed. And that was difficult, right? Because all my family members, past relationships, et cetera, all have, you know, access to that. But I didn't care. You know, that was the point. Judgment by others is not something I want to be defined by or confined by anymore. You know, sort of more for myself, you know, the thing that I've tried to force myself to do, it's to be with myself, just by myself, completely in the raw. So I'll force myself to stand in front of the mirror, right? That same mirror that I stood in front of when I was 12 years old. I'll force myself to be there for, you know, extended period of time, unclothed, completely vulnerable. And I'm just trying to train myself to not focus on the flaws, to ultimately not even see them, and get more comfortable myself, you know, with myself and with my body in its most natural state and form. You know, it's this no BS, no running, no hiding exercise, right? In radical self-acceptance. And it's a really, really powerful exercise and experience to have.
I hope if there's one thing people take away from this episode, it's that we all really can benefit from moments in the mirror where we look at ourselves mm-hmm. as more than a body, but as a whole being, and accept ourselves. So I love that. And it brings me to one of my last questions, Antonio. If you could close your eyes and go back to that original mirror with the 12-year-old boy who was crying every night, what would you say to him knowing what you know now?
Wow. There's a lot probably that I'd want to say. You know, I'd tell him that I love him. Believe it or not, there's people in this world who really can't live without you. Yeah, I don't think I'd be able to believe that fully at the time, but I think it would help. That's probably, you know, what I'd say to little Antonio.
I love that. And this is my last question for you, Antonio. I want you to finish my sentence. To me, happiness is
self-acceptance.
I love that.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Antonio, for just being so raw and real and unshaming with all of us. Thank you for sharing your story.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for giving me the opportunity. It's extremely therapeutic, extremely cathartic, and it's extremely important.
I'm Jorgen Salves, and you've been listening to Unshaming. For more information about anyone featured on this show, Follow us on Instagram at Unshaming or visit unshamingpodcast.com. If you liked this episode, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. If you have questions or want to tell us what you're unshaming, DM us on Instagram or email us at unshamingpodcast@gmail.com. Special thanks to Mirzi for generously providing her original music. You can find her wherever you stream. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next time.